I call the meeting of the Minnesota House of Representatives Higher Education, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Member, please take your seats, and we will be continuing to pass out the original copies for all of our members of the Regent candidates that have been moved forward. There is a quorum present, and I wanted to ask if anybody wanted to move the minutes from yesterday.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, so there's been a motion to approve the minutes for January 15th, 2019 by Senator Lean. Did I say Senator?
You sure you want to promote me? Or demote me?
Representative Lean, we want you to be a representative for a long time. So Representative Lean moves the approval of the minutes for January 15th, 2019. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the motion prevails. Oh, no, we have to vote on it. Excuse me. All those in favor approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay, the motion prevails. Okay, we have a great opportunity today to bring forth our Regent candidates, and I will have the Jim Erickson, who is the orientation
committee chair
for them, and so he is going to stage this for them, and each of the Regent candidates will introduce themselves.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and for the opportunity. We think this gives a chance for them to get introduced to you in a much more efficient way than chasing you throughout the halls, and you can see there. So in order, I think if we put those packages together, you'll get to do that. We just finished an hour and a half long briefing session, orientation session for these 15 now candidates for the Board of Regents. Many of you have been gracious enough to meet with them already. I can assure you the rest of they will continue to ask to meet with you. But Chair Bernardi thought this would be a good way for you could put a name with a face, know a little bit about them. It's going to be a lightning round. We'll ask them to come up by category and just take 1 minute, and somebody will go bzzz if they take more than 1 minute. But this is speed dating. Mm-hmm. That's what we're going to do. So first of all, there are four candidates for the student regent. The first one is James Farnsworth. The next, Michael Kenyatta, is in his first day of class in Duluth, so he did not come today, could not come, but he did participate on our conference call. Then Sarah Kettering and Joshua Preston. So, James, you are first up, and his resume should be at the top of your pile if we got this right, or close to it.
Right, and before we proceed, I would like to mention that we will have our committee legislative assistant, Addie Miller, put up a sign when you have 15 seconds left so you have a sense of how long a minute is. And I know all of our members here are used to putting together 1 minute and 2 minute responses on complex questions, so I know you can do it. So thank you and welcome to our committee, James Farnsworth, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is James Farnsworth. I'm a junior at the University of Minnesota studying human resource development in the College of Education and Human Development. I thought long and hard when this position opened. You know, I get one opportunity as a student enrolled at the university to participate or to apply for the student at-large seat on the Board of Regents. And I thought long and hard about the governance experience I have at the university. I'm the chief of staff for our undergraduate student government, the Minnesota Student Association, and some of my governance experience that's off campus, that's reflected on my handout, and I decided to throw my hat in the ring. I'm looking forward to talking with many of you more in detail over the next few weeks. Thank you for your service here at the legislature, and thank you for having me today.
Thank you very much. Job well done.
Thank you. Candidate Sarah Kettering.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and thank you, committee. My name is Sarah Kettering.
And go ahead.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Kettering. I am a regent candidate at large. I represent a student population, and yet I also know I represent the entire state of Minnesota when I applied for this gig. I am a student of public health at the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. I just spent the last 8 years in nonprofit management and governance, and wanted to give back in a way as this opportunity arose. I am studying community health promotion at the school with an interest in aging and geriatrics. Something that is a motivation, both personal and professional. My father passed away from early onset Alzheimer's this past April, and this is a way for me to give back to other families going through similar situations like that in a dignified and healthy way. So it would be an honor to serve. I look forward to talking more with you if I haven't already, and thank you for your service, as especially as the session gets going. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I do want to add that we passed the person who was, we said that couldn't make it today, but his name is Mike Kenyana, and I just wanted to point him out.
His resume is in the okay. Candidate Joshua Preston, and would you kind of come in order? You know who's coming next, so whoever's going to be on deck, which would be Allison Barman, would be your handy. Okay. Very good, Allison.
And you may proceed. And Joshua, do you prefer Joshua Pandora Preston or Joshua Preston?
Joshua Preston is fine, Madam.
That's
Chair.
How I first got to be introduced to you, so I thought that was possibly it. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joshua Preston. I'm from Montevideo, Minnesota. I attended the University of Minnesota Morris, where I studied political science and history. Currently, I'm a law student at the University of Minnesota Law School, where I'm participating in the Consumer Protection Clinics and the Rural Immigration Access Clinic. Additionally, I'm an infantryman in the Minnesota National Guard, serving out of the 2136th Combined Arms Battalion out of Thief River Falls. I'm running to serve as the serve the university as a student regent for two reasons. First is the years of experience I have within system-wide university student governance at every level, from the Morris Campus Student Association to the University System-Wide Student Senate, to most recently as the chair of the student representatives to the Board of Regents. Additionally, in addition to that experience within the university, I can bring to this position lived experience, which I don't have a chance to talk to now in my remaining 15 seconds, but I hope to share my story with you over the next few weeks. So thank you very much for your time.
And thank you, Mr. Preston.
Madam Chair, candidate Peggy Lucas is not in town. I believe in the materials that were put together that are not in the package you just got, but if you look in the materials that were in your Peggy Lucas's material is there, but she wasn't here today to do that, and she regrets that.
And I would like to mention that is Regent Peggy Lucas.
Regent Peggy Lucas. Okay. Pardon me, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, well, welcome to our committee, Allison Barman, and you may proceed.
Great. Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Thank you, representatives, for your service and for the opportunity to say hello today. My name is Allison Barman. My current day job is the Strategy and Learning Vice President at the Bush Foundation here in St. Paul. Previous to that, I worked with the Itasca Project, a group of CEOs and civic leaders working on economic competitiveness. I've been a strategy consultant and an engineer. And through all that, I have developed strong analytical and strategic skills that I think the Board of Regents could really leverage. The reason the university matters to me is that it has opened countless doors for my family, for myself, and it has been really important in a lot of the work I've done professionally, working on education, economic development, and many, many issues to Minnesota. And those are the reasons I'd like to serve. Thank you again for your time. I look forward to telling you more about myself and the reasons I care about the university over the course of the next few weeks. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mr. Erickson?
Candidate Janie Mayeron, 5th District.
Good afternoon, Chairman Bernardi. Yeah,
and welcome to our committee, Janie Mayeron. You may proceed.
Thank you. Sorry. I'm Janie Mayeron. I'm here as a candidate for the 5th District. I'm a two-time Gopher, meaning I did my undergraduate work here, and I graduated from law school here. I am now retired as a federal magistrate judge. I was in private practice for about 27 years. I mediated, I litigated, and then was a federal judge for the Federal District Court. I am here because I would enjoy the opportunity to assist the university in shepherding it in what I think are very exciting times for us. We have a new president, we have a new governor, and I think both are very committed to higher education and in particular to what the University of Minnesota offers in conjunction with its other higher education systems. I believe that my commitment to the university, as evidenced by my role with the UMAA, my skill set, and my governance experience, which is set out in my biography, and hopefully I'll be able to discuss it with you, would serve the state and the Board of Regents and the university well. Look forward to talking with more of you as the weeks progress. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, candidate Lynn Abram.
Madam Chair.
Well, welcome to the committee, Lynn Abrahamson, and you may proceed.
Great. Thank you, everyone. I'm Lynn Abrahamson. I grew up in Sandstone, Minnesota, greater part of Minnesota, and was a scholarship student to the university. It opened a lot of doors for me, and I'm forever grateful. I actually then, my first job out of school was actually working at university hospitals, and it seems to be that I intersect with the university throughout my career. So after spending some time there, I did get an MHA degree. I became a hospital administrator, had a long career as a business leader in healthcare. At one point, I actually worked on the integration team between Fairview and the university. So I believe my skills based on that healthcare expertise as well as long years in boardrooms as a board member or as a CEO would serve me well because I do have that experience. I would very much like to serve, and I would be just ecstatic to be serving with the first university president to support her. The last thing I'll leave you with is when I first got the call to ask me if I would be interested in doing this, I was doodling on a little sheet of paper, and I realized later I was doodling my number, which was my student ID. So I remember my student ID numbers. Strange. And I evidently have 15 seconds left, but I look forward to seeing everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Erickson?
Madam Chair, candidate Susan Adams Lloyd.
Welcome to our committee, Ms. Susan Adams Lloyd. You may proceed.
Thanks, Chair Bernardi. Good afternoon. I'm Susan Adams Lloyd from a family of four generations of Gophers, and I'm also the CEO of Better Business Bureau, a statewide organization and largest business association in the Upper Midwest with 7,200 members. I bring a unique perspective in that I have over four decades of business experience while also being a recent college graduate. Having graduated with a degree from Harvard University last May, I also have degrees from the University of Minnesota and Mankato State University and bring that perspective of lifelong learning. I've served on many boards and volunteered in many situations, having chaired six governance boards, including the University of Minnesota Alumni Association and the Minneapolis Regional Chamber. I'm here because I want to bring my vast experience of governance as well as business acumen to an institution I love and to which I owe much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Erickson?
Madam Chair, candidate Robert Eddy. Oh, excuse me, candidate Mary Davenport. Pardon me.
Dr. Mary Davenport, welcome to the committee. You may proceed.
Chair Bernardi, members, thank you for getting to know us this afternoon. I'd like to offer three highlights as to why I would make an effective regent in promotion of the University of Minnesota and their mission. First, I have over 30 years of higher education experience and experience in higher education governance. Second, I have visited every campus of the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State and have seen the amazing accomplishments, promising practices, and yes, the challenges. I have a wide and deep lens for higher education, not just in Minnesota, but through my national engagement and international as well. And third, and this is really the bottom line, I have a passion to enable student success and to build opportunities throughout Minnesota for our students, and I have the successful track record that demonstrates that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Erickson.
Madam Chair, candidate Robert Eddy.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee, Robert Eddy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Robert Eddy. I'm from Big Lake, Minnesota. I'm a University of Minnesota engineer, retired now, which means I'm only on three boards as compared to what it was when I was working. But thank you for having me here today. My interest in this position is that for this university to be the very best at what they do. It is my university. It is our university from the standpoint of the state of Minnesota, the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And for six of the people on this committee, it is our university also. We do some things right. If you look at my talking points, we do some things right. And I've got a few of them listed there, both in rank of one of our schools, CFANs. We do some things that need improvement, and that's quite frankly why I'm here. Some of our class ranking, or college rankings, excuse me, some of our facilities, et cetera, and that's where I would like to contribute, is to bring our standards up.
Thank you very much for your remarks, and we will move on. Mr. Erickson, go ahead.
Madam Chair, candidate Eileen Herr.
Madam Chair,
and welcome to the committee, Eileen Herr.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Eileen Herr, and I'm very honored to be here to ask for your consideration and your selection to the Minnesota Board of Regents. The university touches on the lives of each and every Minnesotan in one form or another, whether it's through direct education or through the use of its services, programs, and the knowledge that it has gained through its research. I am driven and so passionate to serve on this board because there is an education attainment gap for students of color, for poor students, and disabled students. What drives me is I want to see success. I want the University of Minnesota to be the very best that it can be, and that it serves all students, that it educates all students, and it puts them on their path to success. So that's why I'm here. I want to ask for your support, your consideration, and your vote. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for your remarks. Mr. Erickson.
Madam Chair, Regent Dean Johnson is out of town and sends his regrets and was not able to be here today. Next is candidate Bill Luther.
And welcome to the committee, Congressman Bill Luther. I think once a congressman, I always referred to as a congressman, correct?
No, I'm a candidate today.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Chair Bernardi, members, it's nice to see all of you. I live in Minnetonka. I grew up on a dairy farm, Fergus Falls, Minnesota. We had parents that never had the higher education opportunity. There were four of us in our family. I received both of my degrees, engineering and law, from the university. And in our small family of four children, we got 7 degrees from the University of Minnesota, which may explain why I'm so passionate about the University of Minnesota and why I'd like to see, why I focus on access and affordability and want to make sure that other families have the same opportunity that we had. I have a broad range of experience in life, business, law, mediation, but not the least of which is serving 20 years here in the Minnesota legislature and 8 years in the United States Congress. I want to now, at this point in life, take that experience that I have for the benefit of the University of Minnesota to make it the best institution it can be. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Erickson.
And our final candidate appearing before you today, Madam Chair, is Sandy Weiss.
Welcome to the committee, Sandy
Weiss. Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you for the opportunity to introduce myself to you today. I'm Sandy Weiss, and I'm here because I believe I have three strengths that I believe I would bring to the role of regent. And those three strengths are my business and financial background. I've worked for three large Minnesota-based companies, and in that I've learned a lot about what the university brings to the state of Minnesota. In my current role, I've learned about workforce shortages, and I've also worked about students not being prepared for the jobs of the future. So I've seen that firsthand and deal with it day to day. I've also worked in state and federal government, so I understand state budget processes, and I've worked directly on federal research contracts. The U last year received $793 million in federal research contracts. And finally, I've spent more than 20 years on University of Minnesota boards. I've chaired the Alumni Association. I was one of the first women on the men's athletics board. So I love the U, I'm dedicated to the U, and I'm passionate about it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present these. I think it'll save a great deal of time of theirs, and you can get to the core. I'm happy to say this is my 10th time on the Region Candidate Advisory Council, and this is an outstanding group of candidates that you have, and you have a very difficult job in these days and weeks to come. And I don't want to leave without thanking you, Chair Bernardi, for the 30 hours of time you spent with the RAC last week, coming to the conclusion that these were the most, the highest level candidates. I think you see they are, and good luck to you. And I hope you will all grant them the courtesy of seeing them when they call your LAs and schedule meetings. I think that's how you can make the best decision for this very important task that you have now. Thank you again, members of the committee and Chair Bernardi.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank the region candidates for putting their names out and their willingness to serve. I know it's quite an adventure, and I think you probably are enjoying lots of it and maybe not so much other parts of it. But we do thank you for your willingness to serve in our state. And what if it's not this time, it maybe is next time. It's very competitive, and thank you so much for wanting to serve our state in this way. Okay, so we have on the next part of our agenda, we are going to move towards a presentation by Nathan Hopkins, our house research, and Kevin Savory from our fiscal he's a fiscal analyst. They will here to present an introductory overview of higher education finance and the funding mechanisms for the University of Minnesota. I believe Ken is the one that's going to be starting, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, again for the record and the tape. Ken Savory, House Fiscal Analysis. I cover higher education here for the House. The goal of the presentation today will be about 20 minutes, and three main things I want to cover are just go over some basic common higher ed terms and terminology, provide some overall perspective on higher ed's role in the state budget and the amount it makes up, and then share some data on some previous higher education bills that members can take with them and then think about and come back to Mr. Hopkins and I and ask questions. So in brief, it's always good to know as a committee member kind of what accounts are within the committee's jurisdiction. Here in the Higher Ed Finance Committee, we have four such accounts. As you can guess, the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, MinState, the University of Minnesota, and then the Mayo Foundation's residency programs. Some common fiscal terms that are often used in the higher education landscape, particularly in this committee over the years since I've served it. One is just the phrase appropriation base, which members aren't familiar to the budgeting process. Here in the Capitol and state government, we use a base budgeting mechanic to assemble the budget. The appropriation base just simply refers to the amount of money that was in last year's bill that is now the base for where the committee will start considering financial terms going forward. The second one will be the direct appropriation, specifically from the general fund. In this committee's jurisdiction, we typically only appropriate from the general fund at the direct appropriation. By that, I mean it's an appropriation for a specific amount of money for a specific period of time. So typically, that would be a certain amount of money for the term being the biennium. So in this year's coming up, it would be for fiscal years 20 and 21. Another term would be the operations and maintenance appropriation, or more commonly termed by many of us here as the O&M appropriation. These are large monetary appropriations that go to both MinState and the University of Minnesota that cover the operations of those universities and university systems. Another common phrase is the state grant program. It's the Office of Higher Education's largest financial aid program. I know they're coming up behind me later today, so I'll kind of leave them to explain that. But essentially, it's a formula-based financial aid program. The state special appropriations are appropriations that are outside of the operations and maintenance. These deal mainly with the University of Minnesota's appropriation article in the Omnibus Higher Education Bill. They are appropriations for specific components of their budget. An example would be, say, for agriculture research and for extension services. Another would be for health sciences. And another one is a system special, which deals with the coordinate campuses or system campuses around the state. Another common phrase that I'll cover is the state share of higher education, which deals mainly with a piece of statute that declares kind of the legislature's intention to fund two-thirds of dollars for higher education, and that tuition revenue would come from the other third. The next three slides are data that members can take with them and kind of consider. They are pie charts, pie graphs that essentially kind of set the landscape over the last 30 or so years of higher education funding and its place within the state budget. As members can see, this was from the 88-89 general fund spending for the biennium. And if you look essentially at the 1 o'clock, if this were a clock, it says post-secondary education, and it says 13.4%. That is the amount of spending out of the $12.5 billion budget in 88-89 that went towards post-secondary education, or as it was newly phrased years later, higher education. Additionally, you'll see two other large pieces of the pie down towards the middle. You see health and human services at 15.8%, and then off to the right-hand side, K-12 education at 24.5%. As we flip the slide, we'll see some of those numbers change and pie pieces grow and shrink. You'll see up in the upper top, you'll see education or K-12 education at 42.4% for the 06-07 biennium. And then you'll see health and human services down at the bottom again at 26%. And then up on the right-hand side, you'll see higher education's pie has changed a little bit. It's approximately 8.8%. And so now we're kind of within the current biennium or the previous biennium with the legislature appropriated for. This is general fund spending for the 18-19 biennium, and these pie pieces represent the old House committee structure. You'll see in the upper corner, you see K-12 education in the 40% range, health and human services again going up a little bit, that pie piece in the 29% range, and then you'll see off to the right-hand side, higher education at 7.2%. So as other pieces of the pie change and the state budget grows and gets bigger, pieces of the pie change, higher education's percentage within that pie changes as well. We go on to the next slide. Here's just kind of a general bar chart of higher education general fund appropriations, kind of a history from 06 to 2019. And it just kind of illustrates kind of the peak point of appropriations, which is currently now in terms of dollars in this range that I've covered, and kind of seeing the good economic times happen, appropriations will increase. And as we leave or enter recessions, they will go down a little bit or rise a little bit. The next pie charts are just illustrations of the most recent higher education bill from the 2017 session. They just kind of represent dollar amounts and pieces of where the money goes within the accounts that's typically under this committee's jurisdiction. Luckily, the accounts have remained the same between the last biennium and this biennium, so we are kind of comparing apples to apples when this committee puts together that bill. So as you can see, the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State make up the two largest pieces of the pie, and then the Office of Higher Education makes up the other most substantial piece of the pie, and then the Mayo Foundation has that little sliver up at the 12 o'clock area. Another way to look at it is the fact that the state grant program is a significant portion of the OHE's overall appropriation. So if you were to put that into the last omnibus bill, just as it say, like its own agency or its own account, it would actually dwarf the Office of Higher Education in, by itself, just because it represents $396 million, as you can see. As I mentioned before, kind of a term that we use here in higher education is from a legislative perspective is the Minnesota Statute 35A.01, which makes reference to the intent of the legislature to provide 67% of the combined revenue from tuition and the state general fund appropriation to fund the other 33%. And so that's what, as you'll hear, Minn State and the university refer to the two-thirds, one-third split. This is the statute that they're referring to when they make those kind of references. The next slide is a fiscal overview of the 2017 session. So this would be the most recent higher education omnibus bill that passed the legislature and was ultimately signed by the governor. There are several kind of columns I'll kind of walk you through, the most important kind of being the enacted column in the center of the chart, enacted FY 2018-2019. Those were the dollar amounts from the general fund that were appropriated from this committee to the Office of Higher Education, Mayo Foundation, Minn State, and the University of Minnesota. If you shift one column over, you'll see the percentage increases or decreases in reference to the appropriation base, which was from the 2016-2017 biennium. And then over on the most right-hand side, you'll see the enacted 2021 appropriation, which essentially is what's referred to as the tails, and those are the planning years that this committee would use to think about what's going to happen in 2021. So when they make appropriations, this committee in 2021, they'll be making planning appropriations for the out years, which is 22 and 23 fiscal years. For a little context on members that haven't served on the Higher Education Committee or are new to the legislature, I just wanted to list off a few appropriations that happened in the last Higher Education Omnibus Bill. So from the 2017 session, Minnesota State received both a partial tuition free at both colleges and universities, which was an additional $91 million in campus support over the last 2018-2019 biennium. They received $4 million for an upgrade project for integrated statewide record systems on an annual basis, and then annual funding for $3 million in supplemental aid to non-metro institutions. Additionally, the Office of Higher Education received a $36 million increase in the state grant program, a $1.5 million increase in the agency's operating funds, and then an establishment or reestablishment of several grant programs around large animal veterinary sciences, ag educators, and pilots and mechanics. So those programs were either established or reestablished. Additionally, at the University of Minnesota, they received an additional $27.9 million in campus support over the 18-19 biennium, $7 million in annual funding for health training restoration, $4 million in annual funding for the MnDrive research program, and then $500,000 in annual funding for the Indian Scholarship Program at the Morris campus. As members may or may not be aware, during the 2018 session, the Higher Education Bill was part of the larger omnibus bill. That bill was vetoed by the governor and contained the following items. These items did not become law but were in the bill themselves. Those items were $3 million for campus support from in-state, $150,000 in funding for ag educator loan forgiveness, and then $300,000 in additional funding for the Minnesota State Grant Program. These last two slides regarding financing cover the small bonding overview. This committee will likely hear presentations from both Minn State and the University of Minnesota about their bonding requests for this year, and then subsequently in the next legislative session when we come back, there will also be bonding presentations from those institutions as well. The most common, one of the most common terms when thinking about bonding from a higher education perspective is HEPR, which is a Higher Education Asset Prevention and Replacement. There's a statutory definition for HEPR. Those projects must comply with that in order to be HEPR eligible. Examples of those eligible projects are things like health and safety code compliance, ADA compliance, and air quality improvements. Additionally, institutions such as Minn State and the University of Minnesota can receive GO bonding for specific projects. These are securities backed by the full faith and credit of the state. If the state can't pay it, that means the state has to enact a property tax levy in order to make sure those bonds are payable. There's certain rules in which you can be eligible for GO bonding, those being has to be publicly owned, constitute capital expenditure, and make sure those are for a public purpose. And as members may or may not be aware, these sorts of bills require a supermajority to leave the House and the Senate. And I'll close with just kind of some general comments on the budget timeline, which members we are kind of now part of. Some of the points were passed early December. MMB, or Minnesota Management and Budget, released the November economic forecast, gave us a kind of a clue on where we are financially in terms of the state budget. In January, obviously, the legislature has now convened. The governor will start working on budget recommendations because the new administration, they received some extra time to get those budget recommendations off the ground. So we'll expect to see those recommendations by the third Tuesday in February, which I believe is February 19th. by the end of February, MMB will release the February economic forecast, and those will help to better inform the legislature and the governor as to where the state budget stands, whether it be surplus or a deficit. In March, the House Ways and Means Committee and concurrently Senate leadership will start developing budget targets. Budget target will be either a number associated with the higher education bill on either it's higher above its base or lower below its base, so whether the committee has money to spend or must cut in order to reach that budget target. In the House, that is done through the Ways and Means Committee via a budget resolution. In April, we'll see omnibus bills leave the House floor, and then we'll start conference committee in early May. Once we get into the early weeks of May, those conference committees will likely conclude. Those conference reports will be sent back to the House and Senate for either for approval or disapproval, and then ultimately those approved conference reports will be sent to the governor for signature or veto. And then we will essentially do the whole process again in 2 years from a biennial basis and from a supplemental basis. We'll come back and do this next time the legislature convenes. And here's just my contact information. If you have any general questions about spreadsheets or kind of where we have been in the past or things of that nature, happy to sit down with members in groups or one-on-one to talk more in depth or in general about whatever higher education finance topics you so see fit.
And thank you, Mr. Savory. Okay. Before we proceed, Representative Runbeck, do you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I think it's sort of quick. Just curious if the budget has sort of a standard response to student enrollment dropping, and what would that be?
Go ahead, Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, in my experience and in talking to, I imagine, MinState colleagues and university colleagues would say the same, is that typically the economy is countercyclical, in that when the economy goes down and unemployment goes up, many people, obviously, as you know, fled back to universities for retraining and new opportunities. And that could be a time when the state legislature may not be in session, and therefore we seem to be a little bit behind. We'll come back the next year, realize that there needs to be more enrollment, appropriate more, and then conversely there may be some kind of mismatch sometimes with those appropriations. But generally they are responsive in that way.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the view of time and the fact that they probably don't have the data, they presented good data. The representative asked a question about enrollment versus funding. It'd be nice to have similar charts that show, the 06 to 19, like you've got, of enrollment, but on campus and online, so we have a better feel for, the distance learning effects. And then MMB, or no, it's admin probably would. Building utilization and occupancy on the campuses, because when you're looking at renovating, it'd be nice to understand the actual utilization. And since I believe that they manage a lot of the buildings, or at least have input and analysis, that might give us a better idea of, when we look at that part of it.
Great, thank you for those requests. And we'll have to figure out when the best time to bring that information back, unless we just, okay, I'm going to ask Mr. Savory here. Is it best to send that information to us, for you to send it to us as a committee, or is there another time when we go into the budget that information is helpful? How would you recommend that?
Madam Chair and members, I believe the question that Representative Kwan asked will likely be covered in some capacity by the university and MinState when they do their overall budget presentations. If it's not, I can also work with them to get you that data if that information is not answered then. But that is a component of what they have presented in the past, just enrollment fluctuation and things of that nature.
Right. Thank you. And Nathan Hopkins, would you, is there anything that you'd like to present now?
Madam Chair, no, this presentation was just the money stuff, which is Ken's territory.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you very much. And this is just, this is meant to be an overview, and then the university and the different University of Minnesota, Minnesota State will come back in and propose their budgets, but we have a lot of new committee members. If anybody else has any questions, feel free to ask right now. And I want to thank you very much for your presentation today. So next we will be hearing from the Office of Higher Education. The Higher Education provides students with financial aid programs and information to help them gain access to post-secondary education. In addition to, and they'll share this with you too, but in addition to overseeing the Minnesota State Grant Program, the Office of Higher Education oversees a number of other state grant programs, tuition reciprocity programs, and provides research and analysis on post-secondary enrollment and financial aid in the state. Today, we have with us our newly appointed Commissioner of the Office of Higher Education, Mr. Dennis Olson, the agency's Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Thomas Sanford, I believe, is here to be able to answer questions if needed, and then as well as the agency's legislative liaison, Ms. Tricia Grimes. Commissioner Olson, would you like to proceed and introduce yourself? A commissioner, did I say Mr. or Commissioner?
I think you said Commissioner.
Okay, I just want to make sure. Okay, and congratulations on your appointments. Nice to meet you today.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to provide an agency overview today of the Office of Higher Education, and I appreciate especially the kind words and note of congratulations. I'm really looking forward to leading the agency, and Madam Chair, those members of our team that you had mentioned that are here today. I've learned in my short tenure at the agency already that we do have a truly incredible team who have helped to prepare this overview for you and the committee membership today. And so with that, I'd like to dive in to make sure we provide enough opportunity for questions and answers.
Let's proceed.
So, Madam Chair and members, a little bit of technical difficulty here. We hope to have the PowerPoint up available for you. But I want to start by outlining the Office of Higher Education's mission statement. OHE has recently completed a strategic planning process and has resulted in a really robust mission that helps drive all of our work of the agency, and I'll just read that aloud. It's to support the pursuit and completion of higher education credential by every Minnesotan, regardless of race, gender, or socioeconomic status, in order to enhance our democracy, the state's economic vitality, and individual quality of life. And we do that mainly through six buckets, I guess, six opportunities. Primarily, and you heard representatives from House Research outline the importance of the Minnesota State Grant. That's the largest section of our appropriation. And we also have specific programs that help with post-secondary preparation, as well as to assist students who have entered higher education and have left for one reason or another to help reconnect, and that's the Minnesota Reconnect Program. As well as self-loan, self-refi program, child care grants, and then those post-secondary preparation programs I mentioned, summer academic enrichment and intervention for college attendance program known as ICAP. And we'll dive into a little bit more of those with related data and appropriations when I turn it over to Ms. Grimes. Secondly, I want to reiterate that in 2015, the Minnesota legislature set out a specific goal, an attainment goal, and that goal is that the number of Minnesota residents aged 25 to 44 years who hold post-secondary degrees or certificates should be increased to at least 70% by 2025. So by the year 2025, having 70% of Minnesotans with a credential, either a certificate or a credential higher, for ages 25 to 44. Now, I had mentioned that includes certificate, associate, or bachelor's degrees, and that 70% attainment rate, this is important to note, that it is for each race or ethnic group that is outlined by the goals set by the legislature. It also includes really important interim benchmarks of 30% and 50% by each race and ethnic group. And currently, and the report is soon to be released, Minnesota is estimated to now be at 61.4% towards moving to that 70% goal by 2025. There are 53.1% of Minnesotans that at least have an associate's degree, as well as 8.3% with certificates. The following slide has some data there related to our race and our racial and ethnic groups. And you can see this is where large attainment gaps persist and where we typically see those gaps that we know from K-12 to continue on into higher education. For instance, you can see our the all bar there, that is where we're deriving our 61% from. And there's ranges here because there's a margin of error calculated within. But you can see large gaps exist with American Indian students or Latinx students and black students as well. And so we know that there's additional work to be done and resources to be targeted specific for those communities if we're going to reach our attainment goal set by the legislature of 70%. And with that, I'd like to, Madam Chair and members, if possible, transition to Tricia Grimes, who's going to pick it up from here and dive a little bit deeper into the data, programs, and related appropriations.
Okay, and before we proceed with that, I wanted to ask you, Commissioner Olson, on page 3 of the PowerPoint, it talked about Minnesota's educational attainment goal. And you mentioned a number of things. Is there any more detail we can get on that, or is that just Minnesota's educational attainment goal? You told us, that's what follows on the next one. You were just highlighting what it was, and
correct.
It's on
yep.
page 4. I just want to make sure I didn't, because I felt like you listed a few things, and I wasn't sure if I missed them.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, that's correct, and we'll get into those specific programs that I outlined related to how we move towards that goal, or our plans to move towards that goal.
Thank you. And Ms. Grimes, would you like to proceed?
Thank you, okay. Madam Chair. My name is Tricia Grimes. I currently work for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I'm actually back from retirement, filling in for the maternity leave of Nikki Oliver. But I worked for the Office of Higher Education for many years before I retired. And many, many years ago, I was a nonpartisan fiscal analyst working on higher education, a job very similar to Ken Savory's. So this particular slide talks a little bit more about the what's happening that is behind those differences by race and ethnicity in the attainment goal. This is college participation rates, the percent of high school graduates who go on to college after graduating from high school. And you can clearly see that it varies quite a bit by race. It also varies by income. We use the whether a student received free or reduced price lunch in K-12 education as a proxy for income coming out of high school, and a smaller percentage of the low-income students go on to college than those who were not low-income. So proceeding along to slide 7, we're looking at a slide that talks about college readiness and how it varies by race, English proficiency, and income. This is a measure of the percent of students that are taking developmental education courses, otherwise called remedial courses. They're courses necessary for them to advance in college, but the courses do not give college credit that will count toward graduation. And so you can see that, it varies by race. It's quite high amongst those with limited English proficiency and also somewhat high amongst those receiving free and reduced price lunch. Moving on to slide 8 is the college graduation rates by race, ethnicity, and type of college in which the student is enrolled. So here The navy blue bars are students at two-year colleges who graduated within 3 years of starting their education, and you can see that the percentages vary by race again. The green bars are those who attended four-year colleges and graduated within 6 years of starting their post-secondary education. So, again, varying by race.
And excuse me, Ms. Grimes, we do have a question, and I didn't preface this before. We're going to take this question, and I'd like to have you present the whole amount of information because you may answer our questions, but if you don't, I definitely want to have opportunity for our members to ask questions after the presentation. But I didn't give those ground rules before, so Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going back one slide to the college readiness, I'm wondering if there's a way to, like, disaggregate the black and Latino numbers and the limited English proficiency, like how much of that high incidence of, like, not being ready for college is about language skills and how much is other things. You know what I'm saying?
Madam Chair, Representative Gomez, we'll have to get back to you with that information. I don't have that right off the top of my head.
So, Ms. Grimes, you do have that more detailed information?
I believe so. I'm not entirely sure.
Okay, thank you. It'd be good to share with the committee. Thank you. Okay, proceed.
We looked at the college graduation rates. Now, another legislatively mandated goal for the Office of Higher Education is promoting access and choice. Here we are on slide 9. The legislature finds and declares the identification of men and women of the state who are economically disadvantaged and the encouragement of their educational development in eligible institutions of their choosing are in the best interests of the state and of the students. And that goal has been there since 1971 and is one of the main reasons for the state grant program. Now, I'm not going to read all the words on this slide. Please don't worry. The office administers state financial aid programs, the tuition reciprocity agreements, some competitive grant programs, has a student and parent information campaign to try to make sure that people know what options there are available to help them pay for college, administers some federal programs, regulates private, for-profit and non-profit post-secondary institutions, and does research and reporting. And a lot of the slides with bar charts that I've been giving you come out of our research team as part of our research and reporting function. I might also just stop to say that we use post-secondary to include all post-high school education, including career schools, trade schools, colleges, and universities. So this is just an overview, really high level, of our funding, about $500 million for the biennium, about $200 million in other state funds, much of which is for the Minnesota SELF program, our state loan program, which I will talk about a little bit more in the future, which is funded from revenue bonds, and then some federal funds. So I'm going to move right along to Minnesota state grants. Minnesota state grants make up 75% of the office's appropriation. So it's the main thing that we do. It's a need-based grant, and when a student completes the free application for federal student aid, otherwise known as a FAFSA, they have applied for both a federal Pell Grant and a state grant. 86% of new entering resident undergraduates complete the FAFSA, and 59% of those who apply receive a state grant. The budget is about $198 million a year, serving 80,800 students at 91 participating institutions all over the state. So the policy formula that underlies the state grant is called the Design for Shared Responsibility. So state policy determines the price of attendance. We start with tuition and required fees at the institution the student has attended, and we add on a living expense allowance, which is currently just a little under $10,000. Very frugal living expense allowance. And then we take that resulting price of attendance and share that responsibility among three payers: students themselves, families, and then taxpayers. And the taxpayer share is further divided between federal Pell Grants and state grants. So we cover as much as possible of the taxpayer share with the Pell Grant using the federal dollars first, and then we kind of complement that with the state grant on top of that. So slide 15 shows state grant applicants. These are not recipients. These are applicants. And you can see that the vast majority of applicants are in the navy blue mountain that is the dependent students, those who are 24 or younger and their parents. The other colored, which are mostly concentrated to the left side of the graph, are various categories of independent students, married, unmarried, with children, and without children. So slide 16 shows how the money goes out according to income. The green bars are federal Pell Grants, and the navy blue bars are Minnesota State Grants. And you can see that the federal Pell Grants are pretty much concentrated to going to families with students who from the $60,000 or less kinds of incomes. The state grant is a little more spread around because the state grant kind of complements what the Pell Grant doesn't do. I think that's a little better shown on slide 17, where you can see the green part of those bars is the Pell Grant and the blue part is the state grant. And so they work together to help provide awards to the students, and the awards do decline as income increases. Slide 18 is a little bit of performance outcome thing. Throughout the income spectrum, the students who get a Pell Grant or a state grant stay enrolled at a higher rate than those who do not receive those grants. So the brown line is those who received a state grant, the blue line is those who received just a federal Pell Grant, and the green line is those who did not receive either one. So you can see that there's about a 12% difference from having state grant in staying enrolled from a first to a second year. Minnesota ranks 17th among the states in total funding, state grant funding to undergraduates. And then moving along to slide 20, on a per undergraduate basis, we rank 16th over there toward the right of the column. Now I'm going to move on briefly to other financial aid programs at the Office of Higher Education. I'm on slide 22, and I'm not going to read all of that in the interest of time. I'm just going to highlight three of those programs. I'm happy to answer any questions members might have about the other programs, but I'm not going to go into detail. The Indian Scholarship Program serves a little over 1,000 students. Minnesota Work Study serves about 10,000 students as help students earn some money to support their expenses as they work while in school. And the post-secondary child care grant program serves a little under 2,000 students. So now I am going to skip ahead to slide 24. And again, I'm not going to read all the words on this slide. I'm going to highlight one program in particular, which is the Minitex and MinLink Library Technology Programs. This is almost $12 million in funding for the biennium. This is a statewide library resource for joint purchasing of electronic databases. So the states and the counties and the library systems save money. Instead of having to each buy into these electronic databases, we have one master contract for the state and get a lower rate for people that way. It also is used to physically share books from one library to another, although that happens less and less often these days. We have some other legislatively specified programs. I'm not going to go into detail on those right now because I would like to talk about tuition reciprocity. Tuition reciprocity are longstanding agreements between Minnesota and its surrounding states so that students can attend in the other state at a price very similar to what they would have paid if they had stayed in their own state to go to college or university. The biggest numbers are the student flows between North Dakota and Minnesota and Wisconsin and Minnesota. So sometimes the question gets asked, why aren't there an equal number of students going each way? And the reason is differences in population. Yeah. Minnesota has about 5.5 million people. North Dakota has 750,000. So even if the same percentage of students flowed each way, there would always be a smaller number coming from North Dakota to Minnesota. With Wisconsin, their population is 5.8 million, so it's not terribly different from Minnesota's, but the Twin City suburbs are right up against the border of Wisconsin, and Wisconsin has five institutions right along that border and recruits heavily in Minnesota. That was the student flow. Here is the money flow. Slide 26 shows how the money goes. Wisconsin pays Minnesota $6.1 million under our tuition reciprocity agreements, and Minnesota pays North Dakota $11.8 million. Okay, I would like to highlight a foundation-funded program. This is not state or federal funds. This is foundation funding. It's called Minnesota Reconnect. It targets former students aged 25 to 44 who completed 15 or more credits toward a certificate or post-secondary degree but then did not finish it, went and worked, or, you know, life intervened. It facilitates them their ability to re-enroll and to try to finish that credential that they were going for. Students work one-on-one with a personal navigator to overcome barriers by accessing financial aid, academic services such as tutoring and advising, and personal resources such as childcare or transportation or food shelves or emergency money to get their car fixed so they can get to campus, things like that. The pilot program serves 150 students at four participating colleges, and it was a grant from the Lumina Foundation for $748,000. And the funds run out in August of 2019. Now, earlier I mentioned the self-loan program once upon a time. That was the Supplemental Education Loan Fund, but we just call it the self-loan program now. It started in 1984. I'm on slide 29. And this is used by students who need to borrow more than they are eligible to borrow on the federal student loan programs. When it comes to total borrowing by Minnesota students, about 85% of it is federal loans, and then a chunk of it in Minnesota is from the Minnesota SELF program, and some of it is from private loan programs. The SELF loans go to Minnesota residents attending a Minnesota school or a participating out-of-state school. So this is one of the pieces of financial aid that can move with the student across state borders. It also can go to a non-resident who is attending a Minnesota school. In 2018, we did about 7,900 loans. And currently, the interest rates are 4.6% on the variable loans and 6% on the fixed rate loans. There was a lot of interest in the legislature in the last few years in refinancing student loans that are at higher interest rates, and we came up with what's called the self-refi program with the permission of the legislature. It serves Minnesota residents who graduated with a credential. There are 5, 10, and 15-year repayment options, and they can do it at variable and fixed rates. Currently, the variable rate is 6.05%, and we are serving about 900 borrowers right now with the refinance loan program. Borrowers refinance their student loans for several reasons. One is to change the length of the repayment term, maybe extend it out. One is to lower their interest rate. One is to consolidate multiple loans from different lenders. Many of the borrowers who use this program had what's called parent plus loans or graduate plus loans that were higher interest rates, considerably higher than the 6% to 6 to 7% that we offer. Some had older federal student loans that were at 6.8%, and even saving 0.8% can save quite a bit of money over the life of the loan. Just a quick set of information on a couple of the outreach and college prep programs we have. One is called Intervention for College Attendance. We've had this for many years. Competitive grants to post-secondary institutions and community organizations. These programs tend to be targeted toward a particular population of students, such as a group of Hispanic students served by Carleton and St. Olaf in Northfield, or perhaps a Hmong Neighborhood Association operating some programs here. And in 2018, we served about 3,800 with those kinds of students. Sometimes these organizations have credibility and entree into the community that really helps us reach some of the students, particularly those whose parents did not go to college at all. We also have a summer academic enrichment program that serves about 800 students. It's designed to prevent what's called summer slide or summer melt in terms of student knowledge that students lose over the summer, and again, reinforce them academically so that they will be able to go to college when the time comes. We have a student and parent information function. We produce a lot of publications that we give upon request to high schools, middle schools, colleges, community organizations. Those publications are also available online. We provide information on federal and state loan forgiveness programs to help people understand their loan repayment options. I'll just parenthetically say that if you have constituents that are struggling with student loan repayment, please let us know. There are repayment options, particularly one called income-based repayment, that can help almost any borrower. There should be almost no reason that a borrower has to default on a student loan, a federal student loan. We do presentations around the state during the school year in five different languages: English, Somali, Hmong, Spanish, and Karen. And we have a relatively new program called Summer Nudging. When a student is the first one in their family to go to school, sometimes they don't really understand that they have to apply before they show up at school, or that they have to go to orientation, they have to register for classes, and they have to go to the bookstore ahead of time and get their books. And the Summer Nudging uses text messaging and other social media to get their attention and try to keep them on track to do the things they need to do to attend college. And then we have the largely federally funded Get Ready, Gear Up program. Now, this program is called Gear Up federally, but it's really modeled after Minnesota's program, which we call Get Ready. Our program was older than the federal program. The federal program imitated our program. Again, it's college and career readiness to services to students and families from low-income background and communities of color. We work with school-wide capacity building, helping the school do a whole range of activities that increase students' knowledge that college is possible and that it's possible to pay for it. And we have quite a bit of outreach to greater Minnesota in this. Currently, we're serving 3,500 students in six schools, and we're set to add another eight schools shortly. And then we have some flow-through money from us on spinal cord and traumatic brain injury research and concurrent enrollment. Now, what is concurrent enrollment? Concurrent enrollment includes post-secondary enrollment options, college in the schools, and other places where high school students earn college credit while attending high school. This particular program is designed to encourage high schools to offer it in career and technical education. And fairly quickly, post-secondary institution regulation. This is regulation of the for-profit and not-for-profit post-secondary institutions for consumer protection. There are kind of three pieces to this that each have equal responsibility. The U.S. government, through the Federal Department of Education, has responsibilities. Our agency has responsibility, and there are 36 non-government accrediting agencies. Now, some of you may in the past have heard of North Central Association accrediting campuses. Nowadays, it's called the Higher Learning Association, but that's one of those accrediting agencies and the one that's most frequently used by institutions in Minnesota. We register and license private institutions to operate in Minnesota, which means we approve their curriculum, monitor their financial viability, advertising and recruitment practices. And that regulation is funded by fees that the institution pays, not from the general fund. It's funded by fees the institution pays. We also work with students to resolve student complaints, and particularly when a school closes, and the ones that close are usually for-profit schools, although sometimes they are not-for-profit schools. We help develop transfer pathways so that students can continue their education, particularly if they are in the middle of their education when a campus happens to close. We have 30-plus mandated reports that are done by the research team on various of the things that the legislature has asked us to report on. And one of our functions in recent years has been the Statewide Longitudinal Education Data System, affectionately known as SLEDS. This is a reliable research source of information on students from K-12 education into college and the workforce. So it's an effort to be able to track if a certain student participated in a certain college readiness program while they were in middle school or high school. What happened? Did they actually participate in college? And it also enables us to talk about the differences in wages between those who attended college and those who did not attend college once they get out into the workforce. We get quite a bit of demand for data from this system, and quite a few of the slides we've used today are based on data from this system. There is also an early childhood component that is currently housed at the State Department of Education. It's been funded by federal funds, which are running out very soon. And the Office of Higher Education proposes to operate both systems, both the K-12 to college and the workforce system and the early childhood component. And then we have contact information for the commissioner and for me. And now we'd be happy to take questions.
Wow, thank you. That was quite the presentation. The part you skipped over, I'm interested in as well, so I think I can go back and read that, but I may have some follow-up questions. We have Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And looking through the slides, slide 8, the graduation rate seems to be parametrically constrained to a smaller population. Looking at the data on 5 and 6, those two slides appear to be a more global population. And I'm coming up with American Indian is 52% that obtain a certificate or higher degree. Asian is 90, black is 57, Hispanic is 55, and white is 93. Do you have better, more global, not constrained data so that I don't have to extrapolate from the previous slides?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Grimes.
If you look back at slide 5, that is data that is any kind of a higher education credential, a certificate, a two-year degree, a four-year degree, or beyond, and that's based on census data. So that is more inclusive where you wouldn't have to add them together.
Yes,
Madam Chair, that's why I said it was more global and less parametrically constrained than the one on 8. The idea that, you know, I assume we're past the point of where higher ed is just a bachelor's, master's, et cetera, and that for the workforce that we have to provide the skills for, many of the certifications, which are some are equivalent to a master's level, that might be good to have a more global and less constrained. That's why I was curious if that was more available so we could get that larger picture. And then looking at slide 15, if you look at a relationship to age on the independent, it might give us a better idea because this is, you know, some of these groups and the independents could be anywhere from, you know, the 20s to their 40s or 50s. And then that would help understand some of the dynamics because support structures for the 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and 40 and et cetera would be slightly different, and some of the mechanisms and flexibilities that would be provided or could be provided are different. So if you had this disaggregated and you know, formatted with, you know, basically the same thing, but you've got it by decade, that might give us, something might pop out that would be useful in what we do.
Madam Chair, Ms. Grimes, we do have quite a bit more detailed information on enrollment by age and gender and race ethnicity, and we can provide more information to you. We're happy to do that. Madam Chair, if I may, earlier there was a question asked about enrollment over time.
Yes, go ahead, Ms. Grimes.
And the slide that I currently have up, I hope you can see it, shows enrollment over time. The top line is total enrollment of all different kinds at all different kinds of schools. So that you can see that it kind of, going from 2001 to the present, it kind of peaked in 2009 and 10 when we were in the recession and lots and lots and lots of people went back to school to try to upgrade their skills while they were not able to work. And in the fall of 2017, it was 262,000 altogether enrollment. This is undergraduate enrollment. And then the lines below are a little harder to see because of the scale, but we have that data in detail by sector, by type of school.
Ms. Grimes, I do have a question about that. Is that in the packet or is that something you can send to us?
that is something we would have to send to you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Kwan, we have a number of people on the list. Is this a quick follow-up question?
Right. Since okay, I had the question about the enrollment. If the additional breakout of on-campus and remote or online was in there, that would help us understand, again, some of the specific costs and structures.
Okay, thank you. Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question on the SLEDS system. Is there like a end point in which they stop collecting data? Do they stop once the students enter the workforce?
Madam Chair, I will have to get back to you on that. I know they track them for at least 5 years into the workforce. I'm not sure if they track them beyond 5 years, but I think we keep tracking them. I'll have to get back to you.
Ms. Grimes, yes, get back to us on that one. And Representative Vane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm looking at the slide 34 on page 17, and I just have a quick question about outreach and college prep. Does the office partner with community partners such as College Possible and TRIO?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Grimes.
Representative Vang. Yes, we particularly, there is an appropriation that we pass money along to College Possible, flow through money, so to speak, from a state appropriation that goes through our office to College Possible. And we also do partner with quite a number of community organizations at colleges and some nonprofits to try to make sure we reach the students, particularly those whose parents didn't go to college and those who are low income.
Okay, Representative Lilly.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Grimes, I just have a question on slide 20, and it's comparing other states to us, and I'm just curious, that just kind of screams out to me, what's South Carolina and Georgia, and what are they doing, how are they doing it, why are they doing it, you know, kind of a thing. Why are we, it just seems like we're really far off the mark there.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, the short answer to your question is lottery funds. South Carolina and Georgia had relatively new state lotteries within, I'm guessing, the last 20 years, that they used, and they dedicated quite a bit of the lottery funds to funding per-student post-secondary education. In Georgia, it's called the HOPE program. I don't know if you've heard of the Georgia HOPE program, but that's basically one of the reasons their spending is so high. And the Georgia HOPE, some of those programs in other states are not need-based programs. They go to all high school graduates that have good grade point average and meet certain requirements. They are not necessarily need-based. Yes.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your enrollment numbers up there, Ms. Grimes, does that come from the schools themselves, or is it from applications for aid, or where exactly do those numbers come from?
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, we have a enrollment reporting system. The campuses report to us on each individual that is enrolled at their campus every fall. Then we go to quite a bit of trouble to separate that identifying number from anybody who could get at it in order to maintain data privacy. But then that is how we get those enrollment numbers, is that they report to us on each individual student that is enrolled.
Okay, follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Grimes, just a follow-up, do we know what the projections are looking like for the next couple years? I mean, it just seems like this is an issue that is reoccurring in higher ed, where we have higher projections than the actual numbers coming in. Leads to some campus difficulties. They're expecting tuition dollars to come in. They're not there. The state, you know, is definitely not hitting this two-thirds, one-thirds ratio, so it just kind of creates some confusion. So it's something I'd like to see, and I know I heard you say it's at the campus level where a lot of these numbers come from, but if we could kind of dig into that and get more accurate projections. But do you know what some of these numbers are looking like for the next couple years?
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, I do not, off the top of my head, I'm sorry, but we can get back to you on that. And if the committee decides to have the office come back and dig more deeply into the state grant program, We do ask the campuses to project their enrollment for the biennium for us as we calculate what we think the state grant program will spend. And so we do have somewhat more detailed information on that. I just don't happen to have it in my head right now.
Thank you. And I have a couple questions as well. One of my questions is on the state grant program, I would like to see a chart that shows the distribution of people at different levels of income of the state grant program money that's available, how much of it goes to the different income levels. I don't think that graph necessarily shows it, and maybe I'm just not reading it correctly.
Madam Chair, we tried to portray that in the one on 16, slide 16.
Okay.
But we certainly can provide more detail on that.
Right. Yes, thank you. And maybe we can meet on it. I'm very curious about who the – we often think of it benefits lower-income people, but it possibly could go to higher-income people. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Sometimes we get questions about the recipients that are from the $100,000 or more category. There are not a large number of them. It's about 4% of state grant recipients. And those tend to be families that have two or more children in college at the same time. And they tend to be families that are going to the University of Minnesota or private colleges, so they're going to more expensive schools.
Okay. Thank you. And then my other question is I hope to have a hearing. We'll have a hearing on the state grant program as well to learn more, and also on private colleges or institutions in our state as well. And one of the questions I have, does the Office of Higher Education monitor that not only, that people, if they get through a program, they are actually able to get credentials for the degree program? So, for example, nursing, if someone gets that training, can they go on to take their state boards and actually get the credentials to be a registered, a certified nurse or however you call that?
Madam Chair, I'll have to get back to you on that. I'm pretty sure we do, particularly with regard to the private institutions, but I need to double-check and get back to you.
Thank you. I'm asking about for-profit, and if someone goes through and I may have said that wrong, but if someone goes through a program that they actually can get the credentials afterwards to be able to do that occupation.
Madam Chair, there certainly was a fairly major problem with Minnesota School of Business, which closed within the last 2 years, that were enrolling students in a criminal justice program, but they were not allowed to sit for the state peace officers training test, the post-test it's called. The Attorney General took them to court. They were found guilty of fraud, and they closed. There is a statutory language that says that if an institution is guilty of fraud, they cannot get state financial aid for their students.
Okay, and so is that something that your office monitors?
Madam Chair, when it is brought to our attention, we do, but whether we do it prospectively, I need to get back to you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, wow, we're doing this committee. It is good use of its time. Thank you so much for your presentation. Did you have any other comments, Commissioner Olson?
Madam Chair and members, no more comments at this time other than to reiterate I appreciate the opportunity to go through the overview, and we'll certainly follow up on all of the questions that we didn't have specific information for today, and do look forward to the opportunity to dive in a little bit deeper into the state grant program. I think a lot of the questions that were asked today could be answered through data in that presentation, so look forward to that hearing as well, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner, and Ms. Grimes for your testimony. Okay, so remember, everyone has homework to be able to come back, and then up to 2 minutes, don't have to take the full time, to share your personal story of how higher education has helped you or someone of your family and how it's affected your lives. So I look forward to seeing you all next week, and I hope that you found these hearings helpful. Thank you. Oh, and I would like to... The meeting is adjourned.